Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome, everyone. It is with great pleasure that I am here to introduce this event and the celebration of the new book, Data Grab, by Nick Waltry and Ulysses Mejias, the two speakers for tonight's event. My name is Miria Georgiou, and I'm a professor in media and communications here at the LSE, a colleague of Nick's, and a geographically distant colleague of Ulysses, but obviously, like many of you, very close in our concerns about some of the issues that they're raising tonight, and especially the ways that they talk about data grab, relations of power around data, what they call the data colonialism. So I'm here to just briefly introduce the event to you and our two speakers and the structure of tonight's event. So let me just start by briefly introducing them alphabetically in this occasion. So I will start with Nick Waltry, who is a professor of media communications and social theory here at the LSE and specifically in the Department of Media and Communications. He's also faculty associate at Harvard Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. He's the author and editor of 15 books, including his co-authored with Ulysses, the co-authored The Cost of Connection, How Data is Colonizing Human Life and Appropriating Life for Capitalism. Nick is also co-founder of Tierra Común, a network of activists, as well as of the European Media Salon. Ulysses Mejías is professor of communication studies at SUNY Oswego. He's also the recipient of the 2023 SUNY Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Scholarship and a Fulbright specialist from 2021 to 2025. With Nick, they have also co-authored The Cost of Connection. He serves at the Board of Humanities New York, and like Nick, he's also co-founder of Tierra Común. Our two presenters will share about 45 minutes between them to talk about the book, Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. After that, we will have a short conversation here on the table to give you the chance to put together your questions, and then we'll open the floor, both the floor for the people who are present here, but also our virtual audience who's with us, and they can also ask questions. The floor is yours, Nick, Ulysses. Join me to welcome them on the floor.
Thank you very much, Mira, for the kind introduction. It's great to be here, although I'm very familiar with being here. And it's particularly nice to welcome my dear friend and colleague Ulysses to LSE for the first time. Tonight we're going to introduce to you the core of the argument of our new book, Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. And this book is a more broadly aimed book that builds on the argument of a more academic book called The Cost of Connection that we published in 2019 with Stanford University Press, which was really the first book-length development of the concept of data colonialism. Over to you, Ulysses.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. So our main argument in the book, Data Grab, that we're very happy to be here to share with you, is that the role of data in our times needs to be understood in the context of a new form of colonialism, what we call data colonialism, which means looking at it in the context not only of the past 50 years, let's say, of internet history, of the history of digital mobile devices, but in the context of 500 years of the history of colonialism. Now, when we talk about data colonialism, putting those two words together might seem a little bit strange. Data, obviously, it's something that we associate with the present, digital data. We associate it with the future. Colonialism, of course, is something that we associate with the past. So how and why do we put those two words together? So to begin to explain the reasons why, it's useful to look at some statistics. Now, as we know, historic colonialism was about capturing land, capturing territory. from the years 1800 to 1875, 215,000 square kilometers of territory were added as colonies every year. That's about the size of the country of Guyana in South America. From the years 1875 to 1914, that number increased to 620,000 square kilometers added as territories every year, and that's about the size of Ukraine. By the year 1945, one in three people were living under colonial rule. Now, as we're going to suggest, data colonialism obviously doesn't capture land, it's about capturing human life through the medium of data. Some statistics as well to give us a sense of the magnitude of this phenomenon. In 2023, 3 in 8 people were using Facebook, 1 in 8 were using TikTok. Also in that year, we generated about 329 million terabytes of data every day. And it is expected by that by next year, 2025, we will have about 181 zettabytes of data, where 1 zettabyte, which I had to Google it, equals 1 trillion gigabytes. To give us a sense of how this phenomenon started and what it means, we also want to share with you this quote by Hal Varian, the chief economist at Google, who in 2013 said, "There is now a computer in the middle of virtually every transaction. Because transactions are now computer-mediated, we can observe behavior that was previously unobservable and write contracts on it." Very important, right? Data is not just being tracked, but corporations can monetize it. So obviously, all of this data comes from us. And so at this point, we'd like to sort of give you the official definition of data colonialism as Nick and I have developed it. We say data colonialism is an emerging order for the appropriation of human life so that data can be continuously extracted from it for profit. So we're not saying all data is bad. We're not against data per se. We're very specifically talking about this process of continuous extraction of data from our lives for the generation of profit. Now, we don't mean to imply that data colonialism and historic colonialism are one and the same. Obviously, for instance, we cannot argue that there's the same level of violence. As we know, colonialism was a very violent process. So there are important differences that we want to keep in mind. Yes, in terms of the modes, in terms of the scales, the context. Colonialism in my native Mexico obviously looked very different than colonialism in India, which looks very different than the forms of colonialism that we're seeing today. But there is one key similarity between all of these forms of colonialism, and that is the function. And that function is to dispossess, to extract. Dispossession was always, and from the start, the key to historic colonialism. How does this dispossession and extraction happen? Through the creation of territories that we're going to tell you about.
So we'll come back to our definition of data territories in a minute. But the fact that we're able to think about what's going on with data and AI in terms of territories is a sign that what's going on might be colonial. So what we're saying is that what's going on with data and AI is more than just another capitalist innovation. It's more than yet another capitalist technique for extracting value. That will go on forever. That's not news. What we think is going on with data and AI is something much bigger than that. It's an attempt to create a new world of extraction, a social order that extends colonial extraction in fundamentally new ways. How? By appropriating human life itself, each of our lives, in the form of data. And if that's true, then the clearest parallel for such a fundamental transformation of the social and economic order is the changes that came out of historical colonialism around 500 years ago. But of course, there will be people who say that colonial frameworks must be irrelevant because we know they happened in the past, didn't they? That's all in the past. It's over. To those people, we would say, we would have had no capitalism without the huge extraction of resources that was the beginnings of historical colonialism. And in more than that, colonialism didn't stop evolving just because capitalism got started. Think about the American slave plantations. They were expanding and growing and becoming more sophisticated at exactly the same time as the cotton milling factories were going on in the north of England. They were directly connected. And this connection between colonialism and capitalism went on to create the profoundly unequal global political economy we have today, the racism that scars all our societies. So why not allow for the possibility that colonialism is going on evolving today, that it may have a new phase, a new data grab, no longer just a land grab. In fact, the next twist in the colonialist-capitalist double helix.
So while colonialism and capitalism continue to co-evolve and develop, the narratives used to justify them also obviously need to continue to evolve. And these narratives are important because they kind of provide the window dressing to justify the brutality of colonialism, to make it more palatable. Otherwise, why would we put up with it, right? So by framing what is happening in terms of a civilizational project, these narratives aim to make us feel like we're all participating in a big project for the benefit of humanity. So these civilizing narratives, if you want to call them that, have been used for a long time. Back then, we were told that colonialism was important because it contributed to progress and modernity. In some cases, it contributed to salvation through the religion that colonizers brought to the colonies. The colonized were told that through colonialism, we would enter a new era of peace and prosperity and economic development. And all of this was justified, we were told, because basically the colonizer knows best, right? The European model of knowing the world was really the best one, we were told. The narratives haven't changed that much. Now we continue to be told that contributing to this emerging social order will bring about progress in terms of perhaps adopting artificial intelligence, which will help us surpass human limits. Maybe not so much salvation, but we're certainly told that this new world order brings about convenience, making our lives easier. It's redefining the concept of community, making it more democratic, more global. At least that's in theory. We know that in practice it hasn't worked out that way. But we're basically told that the CEO in this case knows best, and the algorithms developed by these corporations know best. We should just trust in them. So as it's hopefully starting to become evident, we are not really interested here in making simplistic one-to-one comparisons. We are more interested in continuities, in using the past to try to understand the present. And in our work, we organize our argument in terms of what is known as the 4X model. This is something that those of you familiar with strategy video games might recognize. The 4X model is what you employ in games such as with this one, which is Colonialism, the video game. It's part of Sid Meier's Civilization series, in case some of you are familiar with that. In this game, you play a colonizer. You can be the Spanish, the British, the French, or the Dutch. And your job is basically to go around this virtual world, colonizing it, acquiring new territories, establishing new colonies, pacifying the natives. And you do that by following this 4X model, which basically means explore, expand, exploit, and exterminate. You apply this model over and over again in this game to win the game, and this also serves as a neat playbook for how colonialism actually works. So let's look at each one of these strategies in the context, of course, of today's data colonialism. Let's start with explore, the process of acquiring new territories. Colonialism is euphemistically referred to as the age of discovery, yes? So how are today's colonizing powers discovering new territories to conquer? And what I want to do here is basically to do this transhistorical comparison of two documents. I want to start with Google Chrome's Terms of Service, circa 2007. In case you haven't read them, like most people, this is in part what they say. When you install Chrome, you give Google a perpetual, irrevocable, worldwide, royalty-free, and non-exclusive license to reproduce, adapt, modify, translate, publish, publicly perform, publicly display, and distribute any content which you submit, post, or display on or through the services. So in other words, a lot. When you install Chrome, you're giving the company, Google, permission to do all of this. And let's remember, you don't just use Chrome to browse the web. We use it for email, for Google Docs, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to compare this to a much older document. This document was called the Spanish Requerimiento. And it was a document that was read by conquistadors when they were about to colonize a village or a city in what is now known as Latin America. Many times they would arrive in the middle of the night, under cover of darkness, stand outside the city limits, and proceed to read this document in Spanish to an audience that obviously didn't speak Spanish and could not understand what was being said. The document said in part, "But if you do not submit to Spanish rule, that is, I certify to you that with the help of God, we shall powerfully enter into your country and shall make war against you in all ways and manners that we can. And shall subject you to the yoke and obedience of the church and of their highnesses. We shall take you and your wives and your children and shall make slaves of them. And as such shall sell and dispose of them as their highnesses may command. And we shall take away your goods and shall do all the mischief and damage that we can." So I suppose if this is colonialism's terms of service, we would click accept and install there. The point, obviously, we're not trying to suggest that what happened after the requerimiento was read is the same thing that happens after we install Google Chrome. But we do want to call attention to the use of this abstract language that we cannot understand to begin this process of extraction of data in this case. We have a much more recent example of the kind of exploration that big tech is conducting in the form of generative AI. Obviously, as we know, Gen AI needs to be trained with lots of data, and that data comes from us. It's our collective cultural wealth, which is being appropriated by AI companies. So we see it as a form of prospecting for content everywhere in human culture. A good example of this is Google's Music LM system. I don't know if you played around with it. You give it some text instructions. I want a tune with guitars and flutes that's very peaceful, and it creates it for you. This system was trained with 280,000 hours of music. Obviously, music for which Google did not license or even credit the musicians. So, of course, while we as humans learn and borrow from each other, I think we can appreciate that this is a slightly different case, keeping in mind that Gen AI is a machine specifically designed to do two things: to replace humans in the creation of culture and in the process to generate profit for a corporation. And we must also remember that whenever we use the systems, we are also contributing to creating training data for them, right? So whenever we use ChatGPT, etc., we are again, in a manner, accepting the terms and conditions of this extractivist interaction. Now, in case you're thinking, well, maybe it's okay because a lot of this content is public domain content, it's interesting to note that the company OpenAI, in a report to the House of Lords, said that, quote, it would be impossible to train today's leading AI models without using copyrighted materials. So obviously a different standard exists apparently for corporations using even our copyrighted work than it does for us.
Another thing that might seem puzzling when we use this word colonialism in relation to what's going on with data and AI is that we often remember colonialism as the project of nation states and their governments. But in fact, today, as always, colonialism is a collaborative venture. In the past, we have the East India Company, a corporation which did all the dirty work of the British state in India. It had its own private army, a corporate army. And then in Spain, there was the Casa de Contratación, which had similar multiple functions, a company for the Spanish state. Today, we have what the great American security expert Bruce Schneier calls the public-private surveillance partnership. That pretty well sums up most things in the corporate world today. The public-private surveillance partnership. But today's colonial actors, the big tech corporations, have a very special type of power, which is radically new from in the past, because they, through their data extraction, know more about the citizens of today's territories than their own governments do. And as a result, and because of the big tech's tremendous role in building the infrastructure for gathering data, for making AI even possible, governments now depend on corporations in fundamentally new ways from governments in previous eras. Let's just give three examples. So governments today depend on commercial corporations to have smart health systems. So the UK NHS recently signed a contract with Palantir, the American company, to be the manager of all the databases on which the NHS depends. Quite controversial, but it's the way forward. Governments depend on private corporations to make sure that their borders really are smart. Yes, again, it's Palantir, but this time in America, because they have a very close relation with ICE, the United States' Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, which you have encountered any time when you have crossed the American border. And then, of course, governments depend on private corporations to make sure their bombs are smart most of the time, as, of course, we've become very familiar in the news in the past 7 months. Okay, so that's explore, the first level of the data colonialism game. Let's now move to the next level, which is expand, creating new controlled zones of data extraction, or as we call them in our book, data territories. We define a data territory as a bounded online space, so it's not land, it's built by writing code, but it's bounded, which means that data can be continuously extracted from it and extracted exclusively for the benefit of the corporation that created the territory, that wrote the code. Data colonialism simply wouldn't work without territories like this because colonialism today is no longer just about controlling land territories. It's always about something more. And these data territories are all around us. They include the usual platforms, the apps, the smart devices, the search engines that we all know are extracting data from us as we use them. But it also includes the AI chatbots that, as Ulysses just said, as we chat with them, they're adding our words to their large language models. So as we use them, we're continuing the extraction. But there are many less familiar areas that are also being transformed into data territories. Let's just mention three of them. The first is agriculture. You may think of this as just the production of food, but tractors today are increasingly computers on wheels. They're sending data back continuously to the companies that made the tractor and the computers, such as John Deere, and in the process completely transforming the relationship between the farmer and the land. There's something in Monsanto's terms of agreement. You remember Monsanto, the GM Crops Corporation, that says you can't even use a Monsanto seed without agreeing to the terms and conditions of Monsanto, which are about data. Then there's health tech, which is now, as the Wall Street Journal said in 2019, an open frontier for the extraction of data. And this takes at least two forms. So we may be wearing a Fitbit or an Apple Watch, in which case we're sending data continuously back to some distant corporation who's probably selling it on to quite a few other distant corporations. Or it works at the level of the national health system. In January this year, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, working with former Conservative leader William Hague, published a very enthusiastic paper on the role that AI could play in the National Health Service. And in fact, they actually suggested that every UK citizen should be wearing something like a Fitbit to ensure this continuous stream of data into the AI systems of the NHS, managed, as we just said, by Palantir. And then there's prop tech. You might be renting a property in London. There is a chance that that's part of a vast portfolio. Today's property portfolios are so big that they're increasingly being managed by algorithms and AI to ensure the optimal rent for the corporation being extracted across hundreds of thousands of properties. But it's not just that. Data is used to vet tenants. Biometric data is now increasingly part of how tenants are managed. You may be lucky enough not to need a key to your front door anymore because you just show your face. It's biometric data is the data on which tenants are managed, which means you can't lend your key to a friend, of course. But then maybe the idea of a personal relationship with a landlord is rather 20th century. So prop tech is also being fundamentally changed. So those are the types of new territories, and there are many more. But how do they come to be? How are they secured? This depends, we would argue, on a new type of social relation that in both our books we call data relations. And here we're building a little bit on Marx's theory of how capitalism is reproduced as a social phenomenon. He argued, and it's clearly still right today, that capitalism is in part produced through labor relations, the commodification of the stuff we do for work, for money. But today, is that enough to explain capitalism as a social order? We argue that it is, and that capitalism now needs an additional type of social relation that ensures that the data grab goes on happening every day. And that is the data relation, which is the social relation all of us enter into that's designed to reconfigure social life to optimize the extraction of data for profit. Ulysses gave an example with the Google Chrome terms and conditions. And at the core of data relations, when we think about it for a moment, is, of course, abstraction. That's what data does. It abstracts from the mess of daily life to create units of information that potentially can be sold for value. It enables the commodification of our lives. Just as the commodification of the stuff we do for our daily activities becomes work, labor that can be sold on a labor market through a process of abstraction. And the result is that human life can become what Marx 170 years ago called a direct factor of capitalist production. Not what we do as workers, but literally a plug-in, an input direct to capitalism. And that's what's happening. Just like the seeds and manure that Marx said, when agriculture becomes capitalized, they become commodities. Now it's our life that has become the commodity.
So another territory where we have seen social relations increasingly replaced by data relations is, of course, EdTech. The technologies we increasingly use to run our classrooms in presence or online, to design our curricula and have it approved through various levels, to conduct assessments, to conduct advisement of our students, all of those are becoming new data territories in some way. And again, the point here is not that we use computer tools to conduct some of these functions, but that a lot of these tools are owned by third-party companies that are extracting data from us and from our students. So there's a continuous tracking through these services. If we think about the university's IT systems, the learning management systems, the student relationship management systems, which are based, of course, on customer relationship management software, which tells you something about how we see students. And, of course, you know, the chatbots, the teleconferencing that we're using right now. So because of all of these technologies, and especially with the arrival of Gen AI tools, what we're witnessing is technology's disruptive effect on academic integrity and expertise, impacting both students and faculty. And of course, when we are confronted with these problems, we are told that many of them can be solved through more technology provided by third parties, such as AI detectors, proctoring systems, reporting systems, etc. Now, we're told that the goal of all of this is, of course, things that are good for us and for our students, personalized learning, helping to make the university be more competitive in financially stressful times, more efficient. But, of course, we still need to see a lot of these benefits fully realized. Let's move on then to the third level of the Forex model, which is exploitation. Once colonies have been set up as zones of extraction, colonizers need to normalize certain worldviews that justify this exploitation. To justify, in other words, how spoils can be transformed into profit at a massive scale. And a lot of these worldviews, you will not be surprised to hear, have colonial roots. Let's think, for instance, about the concept of cheap nature. Now, in order to colonize the world, the colonizer had to imagine or think of nature as something that is cheap. It was abundant. It was just there for the taking. It was free. It didn't have an owner, at least a civilized owner. Of course, we know a lot of people were living in those territories, but they were not considered civilized, able to manage those territories. So colonizers were able to think of them as just there. Cheap and abundant. Now, in order for nature to be converted into profit, of course, you need a lot of labor. And so labor was then seen as something that was cheap. In colonialism, of course, as we know, it was a racialized social order, so the labor of certain groups of people was seen as being worth less than other kinds of labor. The contribution of certain groups of humans was basically just seen as something that was just meant to improve the system. That was the whole purpose of this class of labor. And this, of course, was framed as something good, that was good for humanity and for the colonized. So you can see the progression from cheap labor, cheap nature, now to cheap labor, to now cheap data. And if you think about it, cheap data shares many of the same characteristics of cheap nature and cheap labor. It is said to be abundant. It is said to be free. Yes, it doesn't have an owner. Yet you and I can produce it, but by the time it gets aggregated, of course, it doesn't have an owner. And then it's only companies with advanced technology that can refine this resource and turn it into something useful, which is a very colonial way of looking at things. And so again, we're told that our only role is to produce this exhaust, to contribute it, so that humanity can be improved.
So as we've been implying, if you want to exploit an asset, it's a lot easier if you can claim that it's just there for the taking. So why shouldn't someone take it? Let's make the most of it. And that's what has been going on throughout the history of colonialism. Under historical colonialism, the phrase was terra nullius, no one's land. This was the elegant legal fiction which the English legal authorities invented to cover the situation that the English colonizers arrived in Australia, found people living there, decided those people didn't count for much or really shouldn't, so let's have the fiction that no one's living there. Then we can just take whatever is there. That was the terra nullius, and the philosopher John Locke embodied his wisdom in that concept. Terra nullius. Today, though, we have an equivalent, which is data nullius. The idea mentioned by many organizations like the World Economic Forum that our bodies, our interactions, just naturally give off data as exhaust, as Ulysses just said, means that, well, why not make use of the exhaust? That sounds like making a good out of nothing. But it's a complete fiction. The idea that we naturally give off data is completely the opposite of the truth. We only naturally give off data in territories that have been built for exactly that purpose, which is what websites are, which is what platforms are. So there is no data nullius in reality. It's entirely a fiction that justifies the extraction. Meanwhile, continuous data extraction makes possible radically new ways of exploiting labor on a global scale. Platforms like Uber are, of course, very familiar to all of us. Less familiar, at least to those of us in the global north, are the micro-task platforms that recruit large numbers of global south workers to work for managers in the global north. For example, to do the human labeling that trains our so-called artificial intelligence models, which in fact depend on human labor. Or to screen the obscene social media content that we absolutely don't want to see or let our children see. But data extraction platforms don't just change the scale on which management can exploit labor, they change the techniques which are now possible. So they enable the recruitment of precarious workers across the whole world and therefore at the lowest possible wages, often as low as $6 a week, according to Karen Howe, the MIT tech reporter. They also enable the fiction, although it's been contested in the courts, that the microtask platform owners are not really employing anyone, so they don't need to provide any social support at all because all they're doing is enabling data to be exchanged between a seller and a buyer. And yet, everything that goes on a microtask platform is subject to continuous surveillance by the managers of the workers. There's no task you can perform on a microtask platform which hasn't, by definition, already been surveilled. Why? Because it's happening in a data territory. That's what a data territory is. Now back to Ulysses for the final, highest level of the data colonialism game.
Right, which brings us to exterminate. In other words, eliminating alternatives to this world that's being created for us. And here, again, we want to emphasize that we are not seeing and we don't expect to see the same kind of physical violence that we saw with historic colonialism. But violence is still very much part of the system. So let me just enumerate some of the ways in which it continues to be with us. For instance, in terms of algorithmic bias, as many cases have been documented already of algorithms, of AI systems that can that basically continue the legacy of colonial discrimination against different races, against women and gender non-conforming persons, and again, of course, against the poor. So we have seen examples of algorithms in the health sector, welfare, housing, education, that have been found to be racist or otherwise discriminatory. Another level of violence is, of course, job precarity, as Nick was just saying, the fact that a lot of the workers in these gig economies are not full-time workers with protected contracts, but independent contractors without rights. There's also the health deterioration that might be part of this data colonialist system, both in terms of physical health, as we see, for instance, in the case of the gig workers we just mentioned, or the warehouse workers for Amazon that work under grueling conditions and surveillance, or, of course, also the mental health that we see in the case of users of these platforms, as they have to deal with addiction, with cyberbullying, etc. And then, of course, there's the environmental destruction that the system also brings about. Every day we're learning more about the immense energy costs of data centers, of factories, of digital devices and microchips, the water usage that accompanies many of these operations, and just the general environmental degradation that comes with data colonialism. So again, our point is that we might all be subjects of data colonialism, but some groups pay a heavier cost, and those groups are the traditional victims of colonial systems.
But in case you're relaxed, Those are just the costs which are already clear. There could be more. We have to think about the future. This new social order that is based around continuous data extraction from every possible body and thing, and its exploitation, if we step back from it, involves at its core, on the one hand, valuing the management of labor at a distance, without obstruction, as highly as possible, making it as seamless as possible. And on the other hand, it values human expertise as little as possible. That's exactly what a microtask platform is. It ensures you can take the whole world of labor, pay them the least possible price for doing something you need for money that they desperately need. And if this is true, this way of reorganizing production, reorganizing how we extract value, will, over time, we suspect, lead to some fundamental changes in our ways of life, always, of course, in the name of a more efficient social order, not easy to object to. Let's just take one example and go back to education. In our view, the way we're using AI today, and particularly Gen AI, in education, but in society generally, in fact, think of how you use it, is subtly but surely redefining what we count as knowledge in our societies. It's redefining what we count as expertise. In effect, therefore, it's changing the relations that we see between a human body and the possibility of knowledge, which means we need to ask a simple but rather disturbing question. If you take a child who's 5 years old today, think 20 years into the future, can we imagine that it will still make sense to them to ask a human being, what is this fact? Or will that by then become absurd? The only thing that will make sense will be to talk or write into a device. If so, what is the future of this institution or any institution whatsoever that depends on human beings embodying knowledge? So, the final part of the lecture, which I'm sure you're ready for by now, is can we do anything about this? And there's no doubt about it, the scale of this new data-driven, AI-fueled social and economic order is so huge that you might think resistance is just impossible. But that's not our view. As the great Brazilian educator Paulo Freire once said, to change what it seems impossible today to change, we have to start changing what it is possible to change today. And that means, for example, expanding massively the scope of the people whose visions for technology we actually pay attention to. As Timnit Gebru, former ethics lead advisor at Google until she was sacked by Google in December 2020 for exposing the costs of what we now know to be called generative AI, as she said in an interview a year on for Time magazine, we really need to let the people who are harmed by technology imagine the future that they want. But I think it should be obvious. We are a very long way from doing that as it stands today.
Yes, and it might feel, in fact, overwhelming to deal with these problems if they have a 500-year-old history, as we're suggesting. What are the chances we'll be able to solve them by next week? Obviously none. But there are things that we can do to decolonize data. And when we think about dissolutions, we do take a page from activists in Latin America and in the rest of the world, such as the Chilean group Pobladores en Lucha, who tell us that because these are complex problems, they must have sophisticated solutions as well. We must work at three levels of the within the system, against the system, and beyond the system. To limit ourselves to only one of these levels might not be enough. So to quit a social media platform might not be enough. We're suggesting that we need to think about things in terms of these three levels. What does it mean to work within the system? Well, participating in mainstream politics, as boring as that might sound. We do need to keep pressuring our governments to pass regulation, antitrust regulation, regulation that conducts impact assessments, and so on. Another example of working within the system that we're seeing these days is, of course, corporate dissent. More and more people that work at some of these companies are starting to speak up and to say that they're not okay with what their corporations are doing, in many cases losing their jobs as a result. What does it mean to work against the system? Well, all sorts of kinds of protests that we're also seeing these days. One quick example I might give you is the group de Liberistas Unidos, which is a group mostly immigrants from Latin America in New York City who work as food delivery workers. And so they got together to demand certain rights successfully, at least in theory. They're having problems having some of those demands recognized, but that's the struggle. In general, this means participating in the politics of resistance. And here we do argue that we can learn a lot from past and present decolonial movements. In many cases, to some of those movements, we might be part of their problem, but we still believe we can learn from them. And what does it mean then to work or think beyond the system? Obviously, we cannot expect the system to fix itself. And even if we're working against the system, we're still being defined by the system. So to think beyond the system basically means perhaps using alternative technologies. The good news is those technologies are already here. The bad news is that it's not so easy to convince people to switch to them, as we recently saw in the case of Twitter, X, and Mastodon. And of course, this means that we also need to rethink digital sovereignty, especially from the perspective of communities, of the perspective not so much of the state, but to rethink how we think about autonomy and independence when it comes to socio-technical systems. We are basically arguing that decolonizing data needs to be a major cultural and public project. It needs to be a large collective and imaginative effort that is needed to resist data colonialism's new injustices with imagination. But we are hopeful that such an effort can contribute to the longer journey of confronting and ultimately reversing colonialism itself. And with that, here's a link to the book. Thank you.
I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you both for a wonderful, inspiring and thought-provoking insight into the book that I'm sure many of you will want to read if you haven't already. Just to remind everyone that there will be book signing and you can get your own book at the end of the event. So I would like now to invite you to start thinking of your questions to our speakers, both to our audience who are here in the room and also those of you online. And I want to take the opportunity to ask the question, the burning question for me first, using my privilege as chair. So you have spoken a lot about we. You talk about we are exploited, our data is extracted, our lives are appropriated. So I want to invite you to talk a bit more about who is the we? Who is the we for you? Why is it important that you talk about a we? And when does the we become not a single we, but many different ways that might, competing with each other, be differentiated and divided?
Okay, I'll start. As the white English guy from the colonial center, I guess. You've already judged me a long time ago, so why not talk? Well, it's a crucial question. I don't think if we are talking here about the need for a social movement. Changes of this sort will not happen without enormous amount of solidarity being built. So the use of the we is not accidental. We need to think about building solidarity about these issues. And that means using the word we, finding new we's that can be created by finding similarities. For example, we need to have more of what we really don't have yet, which is the people in, you know, plush office jobs, maybe who can work at home easily and so on, which maybe many of those of us in this room, feel solidarity for the Amazon worker on the warehouse floor who doesn't know those comforts, who is literally surveilled every moment of every day, that every movement of their body is tracked. It's a condition that is absolutely incompatible with any autonomy or human dignity, as Kate Vredeberg, a philosopher at LSE, argued in a recent piece. If we can't find solidarity, that build a we, then we're in trouble in building the necessary social change. So I would defend the use of the word we because it's politically necessary. But of course, you're absolutely right. We're all very differently positioned by this. As Ulysses emphasized a number of points, those who were colonized in the past, those who got the worst end of the extraction, will continue, broadly speaking, to be those same people. That's not entirely true. They're all white, working class Amazon workers in the Midwest in America who maybe would not see themselves as a victim of colonialism, but they are certainly victims of this. But there are very broad similarities in the data sets of who are victims, and that's the other side of the question. I'm sure Ulysses will say a lot more about that.
I would just add that, yes, the effects of data colonialism are not evenly distributed. So even though we do argue that in some ways we are all colonized subjects, I mean, if you have a phone, I guess, you know, you fall into that category. As Nick is saying, we do try to make a distinction by recognizing that the historical legacy of colonialism continues, and so some victims of the previous forms of oppression and extraction and dispossession continue to pay a heavier cost. But we do try to be inclusive in terms of creating solutions, which is also why we created the network you mentioned, Tierra Común, which I do want to acknowledge. Our other co-founder is sitting right there, Paola Ricarte. So that is an attempt to create this inclusive solutions and groups of people interested in working towards decolonizing our data.
Thank you. The floor is yours. We have, let me see, we might collect a couple of questions. Do we have a mic?
Yes.
Hi. Can we have one there in the middle at the top, two, three, and then we will have a second round. I can see another three questions at least, but we'll start with those three, and then we'll take the next three. Yes.
Hi, thank you so much. I am a master's student at the LSE, and I have the following question. So as nation states increasingly depend on technology for domestic affairs and also for geopolitical influence, but at the same time likely fear the tech giants' overpowering potential, how do you anticipate the dynamics between corporations and nation states evolving in this context?
I couldn't hear.
Can you repeat the last part?
It's hard to hear.
How do you anticipate the dynamics between corporations and nation states evolving in this context?
Okay. The general culture and political context. Okay, we'll take the two questions there. Yes, please.
Thank you very much. I would like to know, how do you think like data colonialism can act as a statecraft and develop for countries like better national interests, and also the differences between surveillance capitalism and data colonialism? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, there was two questions, two good questions. Thank you.
Yes, hi. Thank you. Do you see data trusts as part of the fight back? Thank you.
Okay. How shall we start? Shall I start with the first
sure,
one?
Okay.
And then you... The very important point about nation states, thank you for that. And we did have a slide on that. But it's a big question. And it's actually, as I know from teaching this topic, it's actually really understudied at the moment. As far as I know, there is no book about what is happening to the relations between nations and corporations. The closest is a book on China, called Trafficking Data, which sort of looks at that from the Chinese perspective, which is particularly important. But there is no general history of this. It's a really crucial question. How do we think it's going to happen? Well, obviously, we're not futurologists. but I think we're going to have a very uneven process of attempts at regulation. We've had some success with the EU. Some of its regulations have a certain force, although it's increasingly unclear how effective they're going to be long-term, partly because the most established EU legislation, the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, basically depends on the liberal notion of consent. If we broadly consent to stuff, or that can be that fiction can be maintained, then it's okay. We have to go on consenting if things change, but as long as we're still consenting, it's okay. The problem is, with a social order, consent is almost meaningless. How do you consent to capitalism? It's pretty hard not to consent to capitalism. You have to work extremely hard for that. So the notion of consent in the EU legislation is problematic, and I think that's feeding through into the new risk approach to AI. There are considerable doubts about whether the risk pyramid, as they call it, in the AI Act are going to be sufficient to actually identify the very broad impacts of AI. I was mentioning Gen AI before, which is having broad impacts on society as a whole, regardless of whether its particular format is a super risky one or not. So I think there are doubts about regulation, whether it's going to be effective. At the same time, that means, and that's why I mentioned social movements that don't operate through the state are going to become particularly important. We are maybe getting to the point where certain aspects of data extraction are no longer tolerable. And social movements are going to be a very important part of that. So there's no way of predicting how those two are going to interact in the future. Then there was a question of statecraft. Which is
yeah, I can take national interest, then you can take surveillance capitalism, and then I can talk about data trusts.
Good.
But yes, the question about national interest is also a good one. And I think we sort of covered that a little bit when we talked about working within the system. I do think we need to work with states in solving some of these problems. There's no way to bypass the state completely. And some states, of course, are exercising and coming up with interesting proposals. Of course, some of them are becoming increasingly protectionist and isolationist. But in the EU, we see perhaps some examples of regulation within limits. I also think a lot about the role of the non-aligned movement, which after the Cold War, if you recall, many states decided that they didn't like the solution of capitalism and they didn't like the solution offered by communism. So the goal was to come up with a third way. So a lot of nations in the global south did form this group called the non-aligned movement, which still operates, by the way. I do think we need a non-aligned technology movement that is not just state-based, that involves the civil society as well. Some people have even talked about perhaps nationalizing data, which, of course, as a response in colonialism, it wasn't that successful. Nationalizing, for instance, the oil industry, but perhaps could offer some solutions. And maybe I'll talk more about that when I talk about data trust, but do you want to say something about surveillance?
Well, I guess it is a burning question. What's the difference between our model and the super famous model of surveillance capitalism? And let's be clear, we were very inspired by Shoshana Zuboff, her early work, the original article. It gave us hope that it was possible to see the bigger picture, which is what we were working on in early 2016, which was the months when her article Big Other came out. So I have tremendous respect for Shoshana Zuboff and the importance of her work. But increasingly, it's becoming clear that there are limitations to it as well. I just mentioned three. First of all, it's very US-centered. It really cannot take account of the completely different relations between governments and corporations in China, which are broadly cooperative. It's design, extraction by design. That doesn't fit with the idea that what's gone wrong in America is that our assets, our surveillance assets, are being taken by bad corporations who've gone down the wrong path. It just doesn't work. And that means that Zuboff's model is basically a diagnosis of a disease. It's, in effect, identifying certain rogue capitalists who took the wrong pill one day, went down a very, very bad trip. And if we could just draw them back, capitalism will be fine. And that is broadly what she said. I can quote you sentences. That's not our view. Our view is that it's capitalism as a whole that is the problem. But this particular version of capitalism we're living today, we do not have the answer to the issue of capitalism or socialism. We'd love to, but we don't. But the form that capitalism has taken in the past 30 years is profoundly problematic, and that's what we're saying. And that's a much broader argument than Zuboff's. And it means that whereas Zuboff argues that if we stop surveillance assets being taken, we've solved the problem, that doesn't tell us anything about Gen AI. Gen AI does not take surveillance assets. It takes everything human beings have ever created, everything we've ever said, whether we're being surveilled or not, just because we were online and there's a trace of it. Or we wrote a book once and it got digitalized. That's not a surveillance asset. So we genuinely think that the Zuboff model starts to break down once the scale, if you like, of the colonial data grab becomes so vast. And that's why that's where the real differences lie, I think.
Yes, and the last question was about data trusts, which I think there are some very interesting proposals being crafted around the creation of data trusts. And I was in a conversation last week or 2 weeks ago with Aziz Haq, who's written a very interesting paper on data trusts. But I did have some issues with his position. One of them, for instance, was this notion that he thinks to the extent that cities can enact data trusts and new laws, they can confront many of these corporations, which I'm a little bit skeptic about. If nations have not been able to stand up to corporations, if Australia did not manage to bring Facebook under control, then I'm not sure cities are going to be able to do much. And I guess the other issue I had with Aziz's proposal was that in some ways it seems enacting this data trust is going to take a lot of effort and technological sophistication. In some ways, I was asking him if this is not just taxation with extra steps. Let us remember that big tech corporations are not being taxed to the extent that they should be. And so if the goal is to create data trusts that can revert some of the wealth to civil society, we can do that perhaps in an easier way just by taxing these corporations, we should be doing. So I don't know if you have...
No, I agree. I agree with that. Tax more. Corporations.
Okay, I think we can take a second round. I can see many questions. I know we have one. I'm trying to remember who were the people who were first. Definitely Robin here was first. But let's go 1, 2, 3. Shall we start from here in the front, please?
Thank you. First, big congratulations for the book, which I have read and agree with, and I also read the earlier work. And my question's been almost asked already, but I want to ask it a little more strongly and pointedly. The one place where I sometimes find myself, not in disagreement, but wondering, is I think you go very lightly when you talk about working within the system, and you go very lightly on what formal regulation and governance is able to achieve. An example that I often think of is that so many of the regulations that are being put in place, for example, in Europe, are predicated on the continuing survivability of profitability of companies, even if it isn't the biggest big tech companies. They won't like to see a whole lot of little companies running around doing exactly the same thing. Still, commodifying data is the answer to economic growth, prosperity, wealth, and all of those things that are sold to us. And so I wonder whether you really think that pursuing that layer is sufficient, and whether actually what really need to go after is overturning in the same way that environmentalists are trying to overturn the underpinnings of it all, and you mentioned it. They steal the data, they take it as if it was free, when in fact it is owned. It's not that it's not owned, it's owned by us. Can you respond to that? Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for the talk. I'm a master's student here at the LSE. And I have two brief questions, and I'll keep them very brief. The first is, do you think that the reason that we have this regime of data colonialism is because of the fact that data and AI and the internet and computers were all developed in either formerly colonial powers or neo-colonial powers like the US and Europe? The second question is regarding extremely disadvantaged groups within society, both geographically and economically. You mentioned warehouse workers in the American Midwest, but what about people who live in sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia who are incredibly poor and depend on other people for their subsistence? And how does data exploit those people? And does it exploit them to a greater extent than it exploits, say, Amazon factory workers in the Midwest? Thank you.
Thank you, professors. I'm Harshit. I'm studying media and communications here at the LSE. My question is on the expansion part, which you discussed in quite a great detail. I couldn't help but think of transportation as another industry after agriculture and education, where technologies such as vehicle-to-vehicle communications, ADAS, etc., based on huge amounts of data is not only changing the actor network within the vehicle, but outside it as well, along with smart cities. Do you think when data and global platforms are so indispensable, data becomes an obligatory passage point, which each actor in a network has to go through for fulfillment of their needs and wants? And if yes, then does that replicate a system where domestic landlords and merchants got cozy up with the colonizers and profiteered more than those who couldn't and are still marginalized even 100 years after colonialism? Thank you.
Robin, thank you for your question and for reading the book. I don't think we go light at all on regulation. It's just that it's not our particular target because, as you can see, we're trying to develop a broader model of how we think about resistance, which has these three dimensions, and regulation is only relevant to the first. But, of course, we don't mean to go light because, actually, we're very critical of the existing regulation. We shouldn't underestimate the fact that the original European legislation did interrupt American neoliberal capitalism by talking about human rights at all. That was a big step. And it's led to certain shifts in the income of some of the biggest players, now as it's being particularly enforced. So Facebook is having to make some adjustments. It's having to offer an ad-free service for a fee, although it may not be allowed by the European courts to get away with that. I won't go into the details. But similarly, some of the playback within the big tech industry from Apple changing the terms of service of iPhones 2 years ago, or what Google is trying to do, which is phase out third-party cookies, are affecting Facebook's income by the order of $10, $20 billion a year. But I think you're right to be really skeptical about these apparently good regulatory moves, including self-regulatory moves. And the reason is that overall, Facebook's profits are going up. It's continued to grow in this period. Why? The core reason is AI. Facebook has developed such powerful AI internally. It now is, I think, is the second largest owner of NVIDIA chips after OpenAI. Means that it can actually generate all the data from its internal reserves, from what we do on their platforms, so that it can target ads with a precision that even the most advanced marketers weren't able to before. And then it sells those ads back to the marketers, who, in addition, because they think it's a good deal, are handing over for free their data to add to Facebook's pile. So we've got exactly the same triangle with exploitation. It's just that the locus of where the exploitation is going has changed, and it's inside the corporation. So I think you're absolutely right to be deeply skeptical, and the same applies to the AI Act, which sounds important because it's banning certain things which should be banned. but it goes very light indeed if you're not in the two top tiers. Then all you have to be is transparent. And any corporate accountant can tell you, well, that's just how you are not transparent, by appearing to be transparent. That's not going to mean anything. And then there's the fourth level of the risk pyramid, which is not regulated at all. So we're deeply skeptical about the AI. So we don't mean to be light, and if you want us to be tougher, we can go on being tougher. Thank you.
But if I can just add something very quickly, because you're right, we need more regulation, better regulation. It's not going to be enough. But I think there's a way in which we also have to be careful about how, about thinking about solutions to this problem in terms of rights, because we can also look at the history of rights from a colonial perspective and realize that, you know, rights were afforded to some people and not to others. And so even human rights, which sounds like a wonderful universal thing, you know, the colonial history of it was that they were used to classify certain groups of human beings as deserving of those rights and not others. And when we think about the AI Act, I think that's very obvious when it comes to, for instance, the lack of protection to immigrants. So AI Act protects citizens of Europe, but apparently it does nothing to protect people trying to cross borders into Europe. Intentionally, I think, very intentionally. I will try to quickly answer the second question. Yes, the question of origins is very important. But at the same time, I think we're trying not to be so deterministic. In other words, you know, these technologies are created in the West, therefore they are bad. Because we do have to think about the role within the West of creating alternatives. And of course, again, when we think of colonialism, it's very easy to just think about the metropolis and the colonies and the center and the periphery. But we also have to keep reminding ourselves that in colonialism, those borders were very porous. And so, I don't need to tell you here. In England, you know, the colonizer came back and so and organized and developed social movements, social justice movements. So we're trying to, you know, not make such a clear distinction here. But we, it is important to think about those continuities. The last question was about how to protect workers, warehouse workers, and it's true, gig workers in Asia. I think, fortunately, there's lots of good examples that we described in the book of movements that are already trying to do that by the workers themselves. So I know in Brazil, there's amazing examples of, for instance, gig workers, women mostly, who work cleaning, offering cleaning services within a gig platform, who are, again, becoming radicalized and organizing themselves. So there's plenty of good examples of workers starting to take up the fight themselves.
But I'd just like to pick up on the second point that you made about the deeply excluded, reinforcing Ulysses' point. Clearly, there are many millions of people in the world who are not online. We tend to forget that, but they're quite substantial percentages of the population. Even in developed countries like Chile and Argentina, they can be 30, 40% at certain age brackets. And, of course, there are many of those who are desperately poor who will never get close to owning a phone or whatever. I think the way to look at that is that the system of exploitation is there, and it will continually draw more into it. In other words, the price of joining the capitalist economy or surviving in it will be accepting these terms. So if we give a few simple examples, Facebook tried to bring in Facebook free basics, as you no doubt know, in a number of countries in the world. It was rejected in India, but accepted in 31 African countries, which meant a sort of stripped-down internet where you were guaranteed to have Facebook as the main operator on your stripped-down phone. There was no escape from that. And that was aimed at the poor, those who would not be able to ever afford a smartphone. That was the term and condition. Similarly, the Aadhaar system in India, that designed by Modi as a way of bringing the extremely poor into a welfare system, those who are illiterate, those who are beyond organized labor. But the price was submitting to a form of total surveillance, which operates, of course, almost every dimension in Indian society with consequences we don't yet know. So I think we are, to some degree, talking about a we that in global terms is still relatively privileged, those who are direct targets. But the price, if you want to get informal cleaning work, and I've never worked before, is to accept an app on your phone which will surveil everything you do, and probably a few other things that you do with your family and so on. So that's the way I would look at the expanding territory of exploitation. Shall we move on to the third question, which was a very Latourian question, actor network theory. You're pointing to an underpinning of the argument, but which we didn't emphasize in this more popular version. We are saying that an order is being built. This is not just about this corporation doing that. That's part of it. But we're all part of this. We ourselves are helping build this social and economic order. You could use Latour as your reference point. I prefer to go back a bit further, either to Marx or to Norbert Elias, who was 20, 50 years ahead of Latour, it turns out, in thinking about how social order is built. But it is about a social order, because everything we do is connected up so that it's impossible to imagine data not being extracted from it. And that's what makes resistance difficult unless we reimagine a different order, which was incidentally not something that Latour was particularly interested in. But that's another issue.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll take one last round of questions.
Shall we go online? Are we doing online or...
Oh, okay. We don't have. Okay. So I think we'll take those three that are close to that end.
Okay. So thank you for your very interesting talk. I have basically two questions. One is since it's called data grab, so basically companies took this data, is there any legal way to get this data back? Because obviously we need data to develop good algorithms.
We can't hear you very well. Can you keep that closer? Thank you.
Is it better? Okay.
Yes, thank you.
So AI requires data, and to develop good algorithms you need data. Obviously companies grab this data, but and if you want society to create alternative good algorithms which could be beneficial for society, is there any legal way to return this collected data back? That's one question. Another question is, why do we trust? So it sounds from your presentation like companies are something which we cannot trust, but we actually can trust government or society or some kind of organization based on society. Why is it that? Why is it better than just regulation of the particular company? Thank you.
Thank you. It feels to me that there are still some issues that can be solved with data. Who should be in charge of those data territories, and how do you prevent abuse once someone has that power?
Hi, I'm a research master student from University of Edinburgh, and we were discussing like decolonizing data, like coloniality of data, algorithm bias in Edinburgh Future Institute. And when I was proposing data colonialism to one of the scholars in my department, Science and Technology Innovation Studies, he asked me, he argued that like, is data taken from your body, from our body? If not, it's still our data. So why it's colonialism? And my answer was like, it's not a replacement of the old colonialism, but as you said, like, as a new target that involves collecting, processing, and applying data. So in my understanding, data colonialism is not just about like who holds the data, but also it's about like who gets the ability to use this data to make profits and produce or reproduce the power of control. I don't know if my understanding is right. And I also would like to know, how do you think of it? And also, I have another question, sorry.
Keep it brief, please, because we're...
Yeah, I know. So the relationship between states, corporations of data colonialism is, and also people, is complex. But also the violence from big techs like corporations to workers and its users like social media audiences is different as well. Like data colonialism from big tech is happening in different way to different group people. So my question is that like, should we define different levels or different like dimensions of data colonialism to figure out different corresponding strategies of resistance. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Please hold on for a minute because our smart technology is not that smart. So the online questions have not appeared. We apologize to our virtual audience, but we will take a couple of virtual questions from there. And in the end, I will invite you, taking the time limits, to combine and answer this, take them all together.
All right.
Please, Ron.
Yeah, so this question is from Amal. What suggestions do you have to engage for ordinary citizens in this data decolonization process? And what do you think about online targeting advertising?
Okay.
Is that the same person or
a different person?
Okay. Well, you have extremely difficult questions to answer in 3 minutes each.
I know. Well, since there are many, I think, links between all of these questions, why don't we just kind of like offer comments on all of them? And I certainly want to think about the legal ways of getting our data back. I think it goes back to this question about regulation. Definitely, we need structures, legal structures, regulatory structures to do that. But in terms of like who should be in charge, who should we trust, I think we need to take more responsibility and ownership for controlling those processes and for imagining alternatives. Because I think it is true that if we rely on corporations or governments to solve the problem for us, the solutions they might come up with might not be very good. As far as the point, thank you for defending the work to the persons who were asking questions at your institution about it. I think part of the problem is that because data is not a physical object, it does tend to create this impression that, well, how can you speak of extractivism if something is not literally being taken from you? I do think that we have to question this notion of data as a non-rival resource, which I think in the early 2000s, you know, it was very popular to think about data wants to be free and data is a non-rival resource, so everybody can use it and it doesn't get diminished. I think we've learned a couple of things since then, and I think we are starting to think of the physical limits of data, certainly when it comes to environmental issues. Data is a rival resource when it comes to the impact it has on the environment, which is not a non-rival, endless resource. So you're right, we do need to challenge this notion that because it's not physical somehow, it doesn't have an impact. And I guess the other thing I would say about the role of ordinary citizens, that's the last two chapters in the book are kind of devoted to thinking about the history of social movements, the people who have been thinking about how to respond to colonial frameworks and what we can do about it, which is sort of presented in the three-level approach that we take. Civil society needs to be involved, I think, at all three levels of fighting within the system, against the system, and beyond the system.
Do you want to say anything about violence? I think the person from Edinburgh also asked something about violence, different aspects. Okay. Well, thank you for all the questions. Just starting with the very first question we had, you say, do we end up trusting governments and society more than corporations? Well, you've clearly picked up we don't trust corporations a lot to hold our data, and that is true. I think I would put it the other way around, that we're living in societies where everyone is being forced to trust corporations for almost everything. That's unprecedented historically. There are no obvious reasons for doing that. There are enough scare stories. And there are certainly very problematic cases. We take India as one. There are many more controversial cases where we certainly would not trust the government to be holding that same data. Estonia is one of the few countries in the world where citizens do trust the government to hold the data, but they do it in a particular way that citizens remain in control of. And that's the crucial point. We have to trust in society as a place from where we could imagine regulating data extraction better. If not, we give up the game. And that leads to the next question, again, the first an aspect of the second question, actually, that was asked. Who should be in charge of data territories? Who should be in charge of what they do? I think this is where, and this is what we're implying by renegotiating data sovereignty. We need to get to a point where we can imagine data that's gathered by women who are concerned about male violence in a city, or maybe a part of a city, is gathered as wished for by those women, controlled by those women, used as they want it to do, and revised or stopped if they no longer want that to happen. Community control is where we need to move. It's not a lot to ask. The data which is absolutely essential to our lives is controlled by the people whose lives it is. We are a very, very long way from this. So that's the sort of shift that will involve governments, and why shouldn't it involve corporations becoming more enlightened to think about that as well? Why not? There are many people inside corporations who are profoundly unhappy with the direction of travel. And that goes back to the point from Edinburgh that it is crucial who exploits the data. That's the other way of looking at your theory. I think your understanding of our book was exactly right. We were asked about ordinary citizens. I just give one example. Continually, cases are coming out which only really make sense of in a data colonialism model. So if you take, for example, car insurance. I don't know if you've renewed your car insurance recently, if you have a car, but you will probably find that it's a usage-based contract which is based around surveilling how you drive the car. Your car automatically does that anyway. It's the question of who has the data. It's come out recently that in the United States, people have been horrified. They've suddenly got impossible insurance premiums, or they've had their insurance cancelled. Why? Because the car gathered data about them, which was kept by the car company, then sold on unknowingly to brokers, who then sold it, of course, to the insurers, who are the ones who wanted the data. As a result, people were being surveilled. In other words, an insurance contract these days isn't an insurance contract. It's not a social contract for pooling against risk. It is a surveillance contract. I think people care about that. And I think we need to these concrete examples that bring home this will have enormous implications for each one of us at some point in the future. We're just trying to look ahead and give us a perspective on that. Online marketing, I would like to briefly mention, it seemed like the crucial or most important topic of all. There's been a reaction in the big tech industry to try and control it. I don't think it's the biggest target. It's not the most problematic area. Areas of surveilling workers, surveilling daily life are much more important than online marketing, which is being forced to adjust its behavior to some degree. But of course, there are always ways around it, and we know they're very effective. And in areas like health marketing, they are very far from being regulated. So it's important, but it's not quite as important as we think.
Okay. We're coming to the end. We know you still have some questions. You'll have the chance to see the two authors outside signing the books. For now, please join me to thank them about this.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.